and stopped. I knew he wanted to add something else, but surprising me, he didn't turn around.
Would you mind if I asked a favor?
Go ahead.
Don't break Savannah's heart, okay? I know she loves you, and I just want her to be happy.
I knew then that I'd been right about his feelings for her. As he walked to the car, I watched him from the window, certain that he was in love with her too. I put the book aside and went for a walk. When I got back to the house, I avoided it again. I can't tell you why I did so, other than that it frightened me somehow. After a couple of hours, however, I forced the feeling away and spent the rest of the afternoon absorbing its contents and reliving memories of my father. Tim had been right. There wasn't any clear-cut diagnosis, no hard and fast rules, and there was no way I'd ever know for certain. Some people with Asperger's had low IQs, while other, even more severely autistic people, like the Dustin Hoffman character in Rain Man, were regarded as geniuses in particular subjects. Some could function so well in society that no one even knew. Others had to be institutionalized. I read profiles of people with Asperger's who were prodigies in music or mathematics, but I learned that they were as rare as prodigies among the general population. But most important, I learned that when my dad was young, there were few doctors who even understood the characteristics or symptoms, and that if something had been wrong, his parents might never have known. Instead, children with Asperger's or autism were often lumped with the retarded or the shy, and if they weren't institutionalized, parents were left to comfort themselves with the hope that one day their child might grow out of it. The difference between Asperger's and autism could sometimes be summed up by the following. A person with autism lives in his own world, while a person with Asperger's lives in our world, in a way of his own choosing. By that standard, most people could be said to have Asperger's. But there were some indications that Savannah had been right about my father. His unchanging routines, his social awkwardness, his lack of interest in topics other than coins, his desire to be alone, all seemed like quirks that anyone might have, but with my father it was different. While others might freely make those same choices, my father, like some people with Asperger's, seemed to have been forced to live a life with these choices already predetermined. At the very least, I learned that it might explain my father's behavior, and if so, it wasn't that he wouldn't change, but that he couldn't change. Even with all the implied uncertainty, I found the realization comforting, and I realized it might explain two questions that had always plagued me regarding my mother. What had she seen in him, and why had she left? I knew I'd never know, and I had no intention of delving further. But with a leaping imagination in a quiet house, I could envision a quiet young man who struck up a conversation about his rare coin collection with a poor young waitress at a diner, a woman who spent her evenings lying in bed and dreaming of a better life. Maybe she flirted or maybe she didn't, but he was attracted to her and continued to show up at the diner. Over time, she might have sensed the kindness and patience in him that he would later use in raising me. It was possible that she interpreted his quiet nature accurately as well, and knew he would be slow to anger and never violent. Even without love, it might have been enough, so she agreed to marry him, thinking they would sell the coins and live, if not happily ever after, at least comfortably ever after. She got pregnant, and later, when she learned that he couldn't even fathom the idea of selling the coins, she realized that she'd be stuck with a husband who showed little interest in anything she did. Maybe her loneliness got the better of her, or maybe she was just selfish. But either way, she wanted out, and after the baby was born, she took the first opportunity to leave. I thought. Maybe not. I doubted whether I would ever learn the truth, but I really didn't care. I did, however, care about my father, and if he was afflicted with a bit of faulty wiring in his brain, I suddenly understood that he'd somehow formed a set of rules for life, rules that helped him fit into the world. Maybe they weren't quite normal, but he nonetheless found a way to help me become the man I was, and to me, that was more than enough. He was my father, and he'd done his best. I knew that now. And when at last I closed the book and set it aside, I found myself staring out the window, thinking how proud I was of him, while trying to swallow the lump in my throat. When he returned from work, my dad changed his clothes and went to the kitchen to start the spaghetti. I studied him as he went through the motions, knowing I was doing exactly the same thing that I'd grown angry at Savannah for doing. It's strange how knowledge changes perception. I noted the precision of his moves, the way he neatly opened the box of spaghetti before setting it aside, and the way he worked the spatula in careful right angles as he browned the meat. I knew he would add salt and pepper, and a moment later, he did. I knew he would open the can of tomato sauce right after that, and again, I wasn't proved wrong. As usual, he didn't ask about my day, preferring to work in silence. Yesterday, I'd attributed it to the fact that we were strangers. Today, I understood that there was a possibility we always would be. But for the first time in my life, it didn't bother me. Over dinner, I asked about his day, knowing he wouldn't answer. Instead, I told him about Savannah and what our time together had been like. Afterward, I helped him with the dishes, continuing our one-sided conversation. Once they were done, he reached for the rag again. He wiped the counter a second time, then rotated the salt and pepper shakers until they were in exactly the same position they'd been in when he arrived home. I had the feeling that he wanted to add to the conversation and didn't know how, but I suppose I was trying to make myself feel better. It didn't matter. I knew he was ready to retreat to the den. "Hey, Dad," I said, "how about you show me some of the coins you bought lately? I want to hear all about them." He stared at me as if uncertain he'd heard me right, then glanced at the floor. He touched his thinning hair, and I saw the growing bald spot on the top of his head. When he looked up at me again, he looked almost scared. "Okay," he finally said. We walked to the den together, and when I felt him place a gentle hand on my back, all I could think was that I hadn't felt this close to him in years. 11. The following evening, as I stood on the pier admiring the silver play of moonlight on the ocean, I wondered whether Savannah would show. The night before, after spending hours examining coins with my father and enjoying the excitement in his voice as he described them, I drove to the beach. On the seat beside me was the note I'd written to Savannah, asking her to meet me here. I'd left the note in an envelope I'd placed on Tim's car. I knew that he would pass along the envelope unopened, no matter how much he might not want to. In the short time I'd known him, I'd come to believe that Tim, like my father, was a far better person than I would ever be. It was the only thing I could think to do. Because of the altercation, I knew I was no longer welcome at the beach house. I also didn't want to see Randy or Susan or any of the others, which made it impossible to contact Savannah. She didn't have a cell phone, nor did I know the phone number at the beach house, which left the note as my only option. I was wrong. I'd overreacted, and I knew it. Not just with her, but with the others on the beach. I should have simply walked away. Randy and his buddies, even if they lifted weights and considered themselves athletes, didn't stand a chance against someone trained to disable people quickly and efficiently. Had it happened in Germany, I might have found myself locked up for what I'd done. The government wasn't too fond of those who used government-acquired skills in ways the government didn't approve. So I'd left the note, then watched the clock all the next day, wondering if she would show. As the time I had suggested came and went, I found myself glancing compulsively over my shoulder, breathing a sigh of relief when a figure appeared in the distance. From the way it moved, I knew it had to be Savannah. I leaned against the railing as I waited for her. She slowed her steps when she spotted me, then came to a stop. No hug, no kiss. The sudden formality made me ache. "I got your note," she said. "I'm glad you came." "I had to sneak away so no one knew you were here," she said. "I've overheard a few people talking about what they would do if you showed up again." "I'm sorry," I plunged in without preamble. "I know you were just trying to help, and I took it the wrong way."
"And?"
"And I'm sorry for what I did to Tim. He's a great guy, and I should have been more careful." Her gaze was unblinking.
"And?"
I shuffled my feet, knowing I wasn't really sincere in what I was about to say, but knowing she wanted to hear it anyway. I sighed. "And Randy and the other guy, too." Still, she continued to stare.
"And?"
I was stumped. I searched my mind before meeting her eyes. "And?" I trailed off.
"And what?"
"And?" I tried but couldn't come up with anything. "I don't know," I confessed. "But whatever it is, I'm sorry for that, too." She wore a curious expression.
"That's it?"
I thought about it. "I don't know what else to say," I admitted. It was half a second before I noticed the tiniest hint of a smile. She moved toward me.
"That's it?"
she repeated, her voice softer. I said nothing. She came closer and, surprising me, slipped her arms around my neck.
"You don't have to apologize," she whispered. "There's no reason to be sorry. I probably would have reacted the same way."
"Then why the Inquisition?"
"Because," she said, "it let me know that I was right about you in the first place. I knew you had a good heart."
"What are you talking about?"
"Just what I said," she answered. "Later, after that night, I mean, Tim convinced me that I had no right to say what I did. You were right. I don't have the ability to do any sort of professional evaluation, but I was arrogant enough to think I did. As for what happened on the beach, I saw the whole thing. It wasn't your fault. Even what happened to Tim wasn't your fault. But it was nice to hear you apologize anyway. If only to know you could do it in the future."
She leaned into me, and when I closed my eyes, I knew I wanted nothing more than to hold her this way, forever. Later, after we'd spent a good part of the night talking and kissing on the beach, I ran my finger along her jaw and whispered, "Thank you."
"For what?"
"For the book. I think I understand my dad a little better now. We had a good time last night."
"I'm glad."
"And thanks for being who you are." When she wrinkled her brow, I kissed her forehead. "If it wasn't for you," I added, "I wouldn't have been able to say that about my dad. You don't know how much that means to me." Though she was supposed to work at the site the following day, Tim had been understanding when she explained that it would be the last chance for us to see each other before I returned to Germany. When I picked her up, he walked down the steps of the house and squatted next to the car at eye level with the window. The bruises had darkened to deep black. He stuck his hand through the window.
"It was a pleasure meeting you, John."
"You too," I said, meaning it.
"Keep safe, okay?"
"I'll try," I answered as we shook hands. puzzled by the strange feeling that we would one day see each other again. Savannah and I spent the morning at the Fort Fisher Aquarium, bewitched by the strange creatures displayed there. We saw gar with their long noses and miniature seahorses, in the largest tank with the nurse sharks and red drum. We laughed as we handled the hermit crabs, and Savannah bought me a souvenir keychain from the gift shop. For some strange reason, there was a penguin on it, which amused her no end. Afterward, I took her to a sunny restaurant near the water, and we held hands across the table as we watched the sailboats rocking gently in their slips. Lost in each other, we barely noticed the waiter, who had to come to the table 3 times before we'd even opened the menus. I marveled at the easy way Savannah showed her emotions and the tenderness of her expression as I told her about my dad. When she kissed me afterward, I tasted the sweetness of her breath. I reached for her hand.
I'm gonna marry you one day, you know.
Is that a promise?
If you want it to be.
Well, then you'll have to promise that you'll come back for me when you get out of the army. I can't marry you if you're not around.
It's a deal.
Later, we strolled the grounds of the Oswald Plantation, a beautifully restored antebellum home that boasted some of the finest gardens in the state. We walked along the gravel paths, skirting clusters of wildflowers that bloomed in 1,000 different colors in the lazy southern heat.
What time do you fly out tomorrow?
She asked. The sun was beginning its gradual descent in the cloudless sky.
Early, I said. I'll probably be at the airport before you wake up.
She nodded.
And you'll spend tonight with your dad, right?
I was planning on it. I probably haven't spent as much time with him as I should have, but I'm sure he'd understand.
She shook her head to stop me. No, don't change your plans. I want you to spend time with your dad. I was hoping you would. That's why I'm with you today.
We walked the length of an elaborate, hedge-lined path.
So what do you want to do?
I asked.
About us, I mean.
It's not going to be easy, she said.
I know it won't, I said, but I don't want all this to end.
I stopped, knowing words wouldn't be enough. Instead, from behind, I slipped my arms around her and drew her body into mine. I kissed her neck and ear, savoring her velvety skin.
I'll call you as much as I can, and I'll write you when I can't. And I'll get another leave next year. Wherever you are, that's where I'll go.
She leaned back, trying to catch a glimpse of my face.
You will?
I squeezed her. Of course. I mean, I'm not happy about leaving you, and I wish more than anything that I was stationed nearby. But that's all I can promise right now. I can request a transfer as soon as I get back, and I will. But you never know how those things go.
I know,
she murmured. For whatever reason, her solemn expression made me nervous.
Will you write me?
I asked.
Duh,
she teased, and my nervousness disappeared.
Of course I will, she said, smiling. How can you even bother to ask? I'll write you all the time, and just so you know, I write the best letters.
I don't doubt it.
I'm serious, she said. In my family, that's what we do on just about every holiday. We write letters to those people who we care a lot about. We tell them what they mean to us and how much we look forward to the time when we'll get to see them again.
I kissed her neck again. So what do I mean to you? And how much are you looking forward to seeing me again?
She leaned back. You'll have to read my letters.
I laughed, but I felt my heart breaking.
I'm gonna miss you, I said.
I'll miss you too.
You don't sound too broken up about it.
That's because I already cried about it, remember? Besides, it's not like I'll never see you again. That's what I finally realized. Yeah, it'll be hard, but life moves fast. We'll see each other again. I know that. I can feel that. Just like I can feel how much you care for me and how much I love you. I know in my heart that this isn't over and that we'll make it through this. Lots of couples do. Granted, lots of couples don't. But they don't have what we have.
I wanted to believe her. I wanted it more than anything, but I wondered if it was really that simple. When the sun had disappeared below the horizon, we walked back to the car, and I drove her to the beach house. I stopped a little way down the street so no one in the house could see us, and when we got out of the car, I put my arms around her. We kissed, and I held her close, knowing for certain that the next year would be the longest in my life. I wished fervently that I'd never joined up, that I were a free man, but I wasn't.
I should probably be going.
She nodded, beginning to cry. I felt a knot form in my chest.
I'll write you, I promised.
Okay, she said. She swiped at her tears and reached into her handbag. She pulled out a pen and a small slip of paper. She began scribbling. This is my home address and phone number, okay? And my email address, too.
I nodded.
Remember that I'll be changing dorms next year, but I'll let you know my new address as soon as I get it, but you can always reach me through my parents. They'll forward anything you send.
I know, I said. You still have my information, right? Even if I go on a mission somewhere, letters will reach me email, too. The Army's pretty good at setting up computers, even in the middle of nowhere.
She hugged her arms like a forlorn child. It scares me, she said. You being a soldier, I mean.
I'll be okay, I reassured her.
I opened the car door, then reached for my wallet. I slipped the note she scribbled inside, then opened my arms again. She came to me and I held her for a long time, imprinting the feel of her body against mine. This time, it was she who pulled away. She reached into her handbag again and pulled out an envelope. I wrote this for you last night, to give you something to read on the plane. Don't read it until then, okay?
I nodded and kissed her one last time, then slipped behind the wheel of the car. I started the car, and as I began to pull away, she called out,
"Say hello to your father. Tell him that I might stop by sometime in the next couple of weeks, okay?"
She took a step backward as the car began to roll. I could still see her through the rearview mirror. I thought about stopping. My dad would understand. He knew how much Savannah meant to me, and he would want us to have one last evening together. But I kept moving, watching her image in the mirror grow smaller and smaller, feeling my dream slip away. Dinner with my dad was quieter than usual. I didn't have the energy to attempt a conversation, and even my dad realized it. I sat at the table as he cooked, but instead of focusing on the preparation, he glanced my way every now and then with muted concern in his eyes. I was startled when he turned off the burner and approached me. When close, he put a hand on my back. He said nothing, but he didn't have to. I knew he understood that I was hurting, and he stood without moving, as if trying to absorb my pain in the hope of taking it from me and making it his own. In the morning, Dad drove me to the airport and stood beside me at the gate while I waited for my flight to be called. When it was time, I rose. My dad held out his hand. I hugged him instead. His body was rigid, but I didn't care.
Love you, Dad.
I love you too, John.
Find some good coins, okay?
I added, pulling back. I want to hear all about them. He glanced at the floor. I like Savannah, he said. She's a nice girl.
It came out of the blue, but somehow it was exactly what I wanted to hear. On the plane, I sat with the letter Savannah had written me, holding it in my lap. Though I wanted to open it immediately, I waited until we'd lifted off from the runway. From the window, I could see the coastline, and I searched first for the pier, then the house. I wondered whether she was still sleeping, but I wanted to think that she was out on the beach and watching for the plane. When I was ready, I opened the envelope. In it, she'd placed a photograph of herself, and I suddenly wished I had left her one of me. I stared at her face for a long time, then set it aside. I took a deep breath and began to read.
Dear John, there's so much I want to say to you, but I'm not sure where I should begin. Should I start by telling you that I love you? Or that the days I've spent with you have been the happiest in my life? Or that in the short time I've known you, I've come to believe that we were meant to be together? I could say all those things, and all would be true. But as I reread them, all I can think is that I wish I were with you now, holding your hand and watching for your elusive smile. In the future, I know I'll relive our time together 1,000 times. I'll hear your laughter and see your face and feel your arms around me. I'm going to miss all of that more than you can imagine. You're a rare gentleman, John, and I treasure that about you. In all the time we were together, you never pressed me to sleep with you, and I can't tell you how much that meant to me. It made what we had seem even more special. And that's how I always want to remember my time with you. Like a pure white light, breathtaking to behold. I think about you every day, and I know that when I see you tomorrow, saying goodbye will be the hardest thing I've ever done. Part of me is scared that there will come a time when you don't feel the same way, that you'll somehow forget about what we shared. So this is what I want to do. Wherever you are, and no matter what's going on in your life, when it's the first night of the full moon, like it was the first time we met, I want you to find it in the nighttime sky. I want you to think about me and the week we shared, because wherever I am, and no matter what's going on in my life, that's exactly what I'll be doing. If we can't be together, at least we can share that. And maybe between the two of us, we can make this last forever. I love you, John Tyree, and I'm going to hold you to the promise that you once made me. If you come back, I'll marry you. If you break your promise, you'll break my heart. Love, Savannah.
Beyond the window and through the tears in my eyes, I could see a layer of clouds spread beneath me. I had no idea where we were. All I knew was that I wanted to turn around and go back home, to be in the place I was meant to be. Part 2. 12. Hours later, on that first lonely night back in Germany, I read the letter again, reliving our time together. It was easy. Those memories had already begun to haunt me and sometimes seem more real than my life as a soldier. I could feel Savannah's hand in mine and watched as she shook the ocean water from her hair. I laughed aloud as I recalled my surprise when she rode her first wave to shore. My time with Savannah changed me, and the men in my squad remarked on the difference. Over the next couple of weeks, my friend Tony teased me endlessly, smug in the belief that he'd finally been proven right about the importance of female companionship. It was my own fault for telling him about Savannah. Tony, however, wanted to know more than I was willing to share. While I was reading, he often sat in the seat across from me, grinning like an idiot.
"Tell me again about your wild vacation romance," he said.
I forced myself to keep my eyes on the page, doing my best to ignore him.
"Savannah, right? Savannah. Damn, I love that name. Sounds so dainty. But I'll bet she was a tiger in the sack, right?"
"Shut up, Tony."
"Don't give me that. Haven't I been the one watching out for you all this time, telling you that you gotta get out? You finally listened, and now it's payback time. I want the details."
"It's none of your business."
"But you drank tequila, right? I told you it works every time."
I said nothing. Tony threw up his hands.
"Come on, you can tell me that much, can't you?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"Because you're in love?" "Yeah, that's what you said, but I'm beginning to think you're making the whole thing up."
"That's right, I made it up. Are we done?" He shook his head and rose from his seat.
"You are one lovesick puppy."
I said nothing, but as he walked away, I knew he was right. I was head over heels crazy about Savannah. I would have done anything to be with her, and I requested a transfer to the States. My hard-bitten commanding officer appeared to give it serious consideration. When he asked why, I told him about my dad instead of Savannah. He listened for a while, then leaned back in his seat and said,
"The odds aren't good unless your dad's health is an issue."
Walking out of his office, I knew I wasn't going anywhere for at least the next 16 months. I didn't bother to hide my disappointment, and the next time the moon was full, I left the barracks and wandered out to one of the grassy areas we used for soccer games. I lay on my back and stared at the moon, remembering it all and hating the fact that I was so far away. From the very beginning, the calls and letters between us were regular. We emailed as well, but I soon learned that Savannah preferred to write, and she wanted me to do the same. "I know it's not as immediate as email, but that's what I like about it," she wrote me. "I like the surprise of finding a letter in the mailbox and the anxious anticipation I feel when I'm getting ready to open it. I like the fact that I can take it with me to read at my leisure and that I can lean against a tree and feel the breeze on my face when I see your words on paper. I like to imagine the way you looked when you wrote it, what you were wearing, your surroundings, the way you held your pen. I know it's a cliche and it's probably off the mark, but I keep thinking of you sitting in a tent at a makeshift table with an oil lamp burning beside you while the wind blows outside. It's so much more romantic than reading something on the same machine that you use to download music or research a paper." I'd smiled at that. She was, after all, wrong about the tent and the makeshift table and the oil lamp. But I had to admit that it did paint a more interesting picture than the reality of the fluorescent-lit government-issued desk inside my wooden barracks. As the days and weeks wore on, my love for Savannah seemed to grow even stronger. Sometimes I'd sneak away from the guys to be alone. I would take out Savannah's photograph and hold it close, studying every feature. It was strange, but as much as I loved her and remembered our time together, I found that as summer turned to autumn, then changed again to winter, I was more and more thankful for the photograph. Yes, I convinced myself that I could remember her exactly, but when I was honest with myself, I knew I was losing the specifics. Or maybe, I realized, I'd never noticed them at all. In the photo, for instance, I realized that Savannah had a small mole beneath her left eye, something I'd somehow overlooked, or that, on close inspection, her smile was slightly crooked. These were imperfections that somehow made her perfect in my eyes, but I hated the fact that I had to use the picture to learn about them. Somehow, I went on with my life. As much as I thought about Savannah, as much as I missed her, I had a job to do. Beginning in September, Owing to a set of circumstances that even the army had trouble explaining, my squad and I were sent to Kosovo for the second time to join the 1st Armored Division on yet another peacekeeping mission, while pretty much everyone else in the infantry was being sent back to Germany. It was relatively calm, and I didn't fire my gun, but that didn't mean I spent my days picking flowers and pining for Savannah. I cleaned my gun, kept watch for any crazies, and when you're forced to be alert for hours, you're tired by nightfall. I can honestly say I could go 2 or 3 days without wondering what Savannah was doing, or even thinking about her. Did this make my love less real? I asked myself that question dozens of times during that trip, but I always decided it didn't, for the simple reason that her image would ambush me when I least expected it, overwhelming me with the same ache I had the day I'd left. Anything might set it off, a friend talking about his wife, the sight of a couple holding hands, or even the way some of the villagers would smile as we passed. Savannah's letters arrived every 10 days or so, and they'd piled up by the time I got back to Germany. None was like the letter I'd read on the plane. Mostly they were casual and chatty, and she saved the truth of her feelings until the very end. In the meantime, I learned the details of her daily life, that they'd finished the 1st house a little behind schedule, which made things tougher when it came to building the 2nd house. For that one, they had to work longer hours, even though everyone involved had grown more efficient at their tasks. I learned that after they completed the 1st house, they had thrown a big party for the entire neighborhood, and that they'd been toasted over and over as the afternoon wore on. I learned that the work crew had celebrated by going to the shrimp shack, and that Tim had pronounced it to have the greatest atmosphere of any restaurant he'd been to. I learned that she got most of her fall classes with the teachers she'd requested, and that she was excited to be taking adolescent psychology with a Dr. Barnes, who just had a major article published in some esoteric psychology journal. I didn't need to believe that Savannah thought of me every time she pounded a nail or was helping to slide a window into place, or think that in the midst of a conversation with Tim, she would always wish it were me she was talking to. I like to think that what we had was deeper than that, and over time, that belief made my love for her grow even stronger. Of course, I did want to know that she still cared about me, and in this, Savannah never let me down. I suppose that was the reason I saved every letter she ever sent. Toward the end of each letter, there would always be a few sentences, maybe even a paragraph, where she would write something that made me pause, words that made me remember, and I would find myself rereading passages and trying to imagine her voice as I read them. Like this from the 2nd letter I received. When I think of you and me and what we shared, I know it would be easy for others to dismiss our time together as simply a byproduct of the days and nights spent by the sea, a fling that, in the long run, would mean absolutely nothing. That's why I don't tell people about us. They wouldn't understand, and I don't feel the need to explain, simply because I know in my heart how real it was. When I think of you, I can't help smiling. Knowing that you've completed me somehow, I love you, not just for now, but for always, and I dream of the day that you'll take me in your arms again. Or this from the letter after I'd sent her a photograph of me. And finally, I want to thank you for the picture. I've already put it in my wallet. You look healthy and happy, but I have to tell you that I cried when I saw it. Not because it made me sad, though it did, since I know I won't be able to see you, but because it made me happy. It reminded me that you're the best thing that's ever happened to me. And this from a letter she'd written while I'd been in Kosovo. I have to say that your last letter worried me. I want to hear about it. I need to hear about it. But I find myself holding my breath and getting scared for you whenever you tell me what your life is really like. Here I am, getting ready to go home for Thanksgiving and worrying about tests, and you're someplace dangerous, surrounded by people who want to hurt you.
I just wish those people could know you like I know you, because then you'd be safe, just like I feel safe when I'm in your arms.
Christmas that year was a dismal affair, but it's always dismal when you're far from home. It wasn't my first Christmas alone during my years in the service. Every holiday had been spent in Germany, and a couple of guys in our barracks had rigged up a tree of sorts, a green tarp braced with a stick and decorated with blinking lights. More than half of my buddies had gone home. I was one of the unlucky ones who had to stay in case our friends the Russians got it in their heads that we were still mortal enemies. And most of the others trooped into town to celebrate Christmas Eve by getting bombed on quality German beer. I'd already opened the package Savannah had sent me, a sweater that reminded me of something Tim would wear and a batch of homemade cookies, and knew she'd already received the perfume I'd sent her. But I was alone, and as a gift to myself, I splurged on a phone call to Savannah. She hadn't expected the call, and I replayed the excitement in her voice for weeks afterward. We ended up talking for more than an hour. I had missed the sound of her voice. I'd forgotten her lilting accent and the twang that grew more pronounced whenever she started speaking quickly. I leaned back in my chair, imagining that she was with me and listening as she described the falling snow. At the same time, I realized it was snowing outside my window as well, which, if only for an instant, made it feel as if we were together. By January 2001, I had begun to count down the days to when I'd see her again. My summer leave was coming in June, and I'd be out of the army in less than a year. I'd wake up in the morning and literally tell myself that there were 360 days left, then 359 and 358 till I was out. But I'd see Savannah in 178, then 177 and 176 and so on. It was tangible and real, close enough to allow me to dream of moving back to North Carolina. On the other hand, it unfortunately made time slow down. Isn't that the way it always is when you really want something? It reminded me of being a kid and the lengthening days as I waited for summer vacation. Had it not been for Savannah's letters, I have no doubt that the wait would have seemed much longer. My dad wrote as well, not with the frequency of Savannah, but on his own regular monthly schedule. To my surprise, his letters were 2 or 3 times longer than the page or so I'd been used to. The additional pages were exclusively about coins. In my spare time, I'd visit the computer center and do a bit of research on my own. I'd search for certain coins, collect the history, and send the information back in a letter of my own. I swear, the first time I did that, I thought I saw tears on the next letter he sent me. No, not really. I know it was just my imagination, since he never even mentioned what I'd done, but I wanted to believe that he pored over the data with the same intensity he used when studying the gray sheet. In February, I was shipped off on maneuvers with other NATO troops. One of those pretend we're in a battle in 1944 exercises in which we were supposedly facing an onslaught of tanks through the German countryside. Kind of pointless, if you ask me. Those kinds of wars are long since over. Gone the way of Spanish galleons blasting their close-range cannons and the U.S. cavalry riding horseback to the rescue. These days, they never say who the enemies are supposed to be, but everyone knows it's the Russians, which makes even less sense, since they're supposed to be our allies now. But even if they weren't, the simple fact is that they don't have that many working tanks anymore. And even if they were secretly building thousands at some secret plant in Siberia with the intent of overrunning Europe, any advancing wave of tanks would most likely be confronted with airstrikes and our own mechanized divisions, instead of the infantry. But what did I know, right? The weather was miserable, too, with some freakishly angry cold front moving down from the Arctic just as the maneuvers started. It was epic, with snow and sleet and hail and winds topping 50 miles an hour, making me think of Napoleon's troops on the retreat from Moscow. It was so cold that frost formed on my eyebrows. It hurt to breathe, and my fingers would stick to the gun barrel if I touched it accidentally. It stung like hell getting them unstuck, and I lost a good bit of skin on the tips in the process. But I kept my face covered and my hand on the stock after that and marched through icy mud brought on by the endless snow showers, trying my best not to become an ice statue while we pretended to fight the enemy. We spent 10 days doing that. Half my men got frostbite, the other half suffered from hypothermia, and by the time we finished, my squad was reduced to just 3 or 4 men, all of whom ended up in the infirmary once we got back to base, including me. The whole experience was just about the most ridiculous and idiotic thing the Army ever made me do. And that's saying something, because I've done a lot of idiotic things for good old Uncle Sam and the Big Red One. At the end, our commander walked through the ward, congratulating my squad on a job well done. I wanted to tell him that maybe our time would have been better spent learning modern war tactics, or at the very least, tuned in to the Weather Channel. But instead, I offered a salute and an acknowledgement, being the good Army grunt I am. After that, I spent the next few uneventful months on base. Sure, we did the occasional class on weapons or navigation, and every now and then I'd wander into town for a beer with the guys. But for the most part, I lifted tons of weights, ran hundreds of miles, and kicked Tony's ass whenever we stepped into the boxing ring. Spring in Germany wasn't as bad as I thought it would be after the disaster we went through on maneuvers. Snow melted, flowers came out, and the air began to warm. Well, not really warm, but rise above freezing, and that was enough for most of my buddies and me to throw on shorts and play frisbee or softball outside. As June finally rolled around, I found myself getting antsy to return to North Carolina. Savannah had graduated and was already in summer school doing classes for her master's degree, so I planned to travel to Chapel Hill. We would have 2 glorious weeks together. Even when I went to see my dad in Wilmington, she planned to come with me, and I found myself feeling alternately nervous and excited and scared at the thought. Yes, we'd corresponded through the mail and talked on the phone. Yes, I'd gone out to stare at the moon on the first night it was full. And in her letters, she told me she had too. But I hadn't seen her in nearly a year, and I didn't have any idea how she'd react when we were face to face again. Would she rush into my arms when I got off the plane, or would her reaction be more restrained? Perhaps a gentle kiss on the cheek? Would we fall into easy conversation immediately, or would we find ourselves talking about the weather and feeling awkward around each other? I didn't know, and I'd lie awake at night imagining 1,000 different scenarios. Tony knew what I was going through, though he knew better than to call obvious attention to it. Instead, as the date approached, he slapped me on the back.
"Gonna see you soon," he said. "You ready for that?"
"Yeah," he smirked.
"Don't forget to pick up some tequila on the way home."
I made a face, and Tony laughed.
"It's gonna be just fine," he said. "She loves you, man. She's got to, considering how much you love her."
13. In June 2001, I was given my leave and left for home immediately, flying from Frankfurt to New York, then on to Raleigh. It was Friday evening, and Savannah had promised to pick me up at the airport before bringing me to Lenore to meet her parents. She dropped that little surprise on me the day before the flight. Now, I had nothing against meeting her parents, mind you. I was sure they were wonderful people and all that. But if I had my way, I would rather have had Savannah all to myself, at least for the first few days. It's kind of hard to make up for lost time with the parents around. Even if we didn't get physical, and knowing Savannah, I was pretty sure we wouldn't, though I kept my fingers crossed. How would her parents treat me if I kept her daughter out until the wee hours, even if all we did was lie under the stars? Granted, she was an adult, but parents were funny when it came to their own kids, and I was under no illusions that they'd be understanding about the whole thing. She would always be their little girl, if you know what I mean. But Savannah had had a point when she explained it to me. I had 2 weekends free, and if I planned to see my dad on the second weekend, I had to see hers the first weekend. Besides, she sounded so excited about the whole thing that all I could say was that I was looking forward to meeting them. Still, I wondered if I'd even be able to hold her hand, and I speculated about whether I could talk her into taking a little detour on the way to Lenore. As soon as the plane landed, my anticipation grew, and I could feel my ticker booming. But I didn't know how to act. Should I jog toward her as soon as I spotted her, or stroll casually, cool and in control? I still wasn't sure, but before I could dwell on it, I was in the cattle chute moving up the aisle. I slung my duffel bag over my shoulder as I emerged from the ramp that accessed the terminal. I didn't see her at first, too many folks milling around. When I scanned the baggage area a second time, I saw her off to the left and realized instantly that all my worries had been pointless, for she spotted me and came running at full tilt. I barely had time to drop my duffel bag before she jumped into my arms, and the kiss that followed was like its own magic kingdom, complete with its special language and geography, fabulous myths and wonders for the ages. And when she pulled back and whispered, "I missed you so much," I felt as if I'd been put back together after spending a year cut in half. I don't know how long we stood together, but when we finally began moving toward the exits, I slipped my hand into hers, knowing that I loved her not only more than the last time I'd seen her, but more than I would ever love anyone. On the drive, we talked easily, but we did make a small detour. After pulling into a rest stop, we made out like teenagers. It was great. Let's leave it at that. And a couple of hours later, we arrived at her house. Her parents were waiting on the porch of a neat, two-story Victorian. Surprising me, her mother hugged me as soon as I got close, then offered me a beer. I declined, mostly because I knew I'd be the only one drinking, but I appreciated the effort. Savannah's mom, Jill, was a lot like Savannah, friendly, open, and a lot sharper than I first believed. Her dad was exactly the same, and I actually had a good time visiting with them. It didn't hurt that Savannah held my hand the whole time and seemed completely at ease doing so. Toward the end of the evening, Savannah and I went for a long, moonlit walk. By the time we got back to the house, it felt almost as if we'd never been apart at all. It went without saying that I slept in the guest room. I hadn't expected otherwise, and the room was a lot better than most places I'd stayed, with classic furniture and a comfortable mattress. The air was stuffy, though, and I opened the window, hoping the mountain air would bring welcome cool. It had been a long day. I was still on German time, and I fell asleep immediately, only to wake up an hour later when I heard my door squeak open. Savannah, wearing comfy cotton pajamas and socks, closed the door behind her and started toward the bed, tiptoeing across the floor. She held a finger to her lips to keep me quiet. "My parents would kill me if they knew I was doing this," she whispered. She crawled into bed beside me and adjusted the covers, pulling them up to her neck as if she were camping in the Arctic. I put my arms around her, loving the feel of her body against mine. We kissed and giggled for most of the night. Then she sneaked back to her room. I fell asleep again, probably before she reached her room, and awakened to the sight of sunlight streaming in the window. The smell of breakfast came wafting into the room, and I tossed on a t-shirt and jeans and went down to the kitchen. Savannah was at the table, talking with her mom while her dad read the paper, and I felt the weight of their presence when I entered.
I took a place at the table, and Savannah's mom poured me a cup of coffee before setting a plate of bacon and eggs in front of me. Savannah, who was sitting across from me already showered and dressed, was chipper and impossibly fresh-looking in the soft morning light. "Did you sleep okay?" she asked, her eyes shining with mischief. I nodded.
"Actually, I had the most wonderful dream," I said.
"Oh?"
the mom asked. "What was it about?"
I felt Savannah kick me under the table. She shook her head almost imperceptibly. I have to admit that I enjoyed the sight of Savannah squirming, but enough was enough. I feigned concentration.
"I can't remember now," I said.
"I hate when that happens,"
her mother said.
"Is breakfast okay?"
"It smells great," I said. "Thank you."
I glanced at Savannah.
"What's on the agenda today?"
She leaned across the table.
"I was thinking we might go horseback riding. Do you think you'd be up for that?"
When I hesitated, she laughed.
"You'll be fine," she added. "I promise."
"Easy for you to say."
She rode Midas. For me, she suggested a quarter horse named Pepper, which her dad usually rode. We spent most of the day walking up trails, galloping through open fields, and exploring this part of her world. She'd prepared a picnic lunch, and we ate at a spot that overlooked Lenore. She pointed out the schools she attended and homes of the people she knew. It dawned on me then that not only did she love it here, she never wanted to live anywhere else. We spent 6 or 7 hours in the saddle, and I did my best to keep up with Savannah, though that was close to impossible. I didn't end up with my face planted in the dirt, but there were a few dicey moments here and there when Pepper acted up, and it took everything I could do to hold on. It wasn't until Savannah and I were getting ready for dinner that I realized what I'd gotten myself into, however. Little by little, I began to realize that my walking resembled waddling. The inside muscles of my legs felt as if Tony had pounded them for hours. On Saturday night, Savannah and I went to dinner at a cozy little Italian place. Afterward, she suggested we go dancing, but by then, I could barely move. As I limped toward the car, she adopted a concerned expression and reached out to stop me. Leaning over, she grasped my leg. "Does it hurt when I squeeze right here?" I jumped and screamed. For some reason, she found this amusing.
"Why'd you do that? That hurt."
She smiled.
"Just checking."
"Checking what? I already told you I'm sore."
"I just wanted to see if a little old me could make a big, tough army guy like you scream."
I rubbed my leg.
"Yeah, well, let's not test that anymore, okay?"
"Okay," she said, "and I'm sorry."
"You don't sound sorry."
"Well, I am," she said. "But it is kind of funny, don't you think? I mean, I rode just as long as you, and I'm fine."
"You ride all the time."
"I haven't ridden in over a month."
"Yeah, well."
"Come on, admit it. It was kind of funny, wasn't it?"
"Not at all."
On Sunday, we attended church with her family. I was too sore to do much else the rest of the day, so I plopped myself on the couch and watched a baseball game with her dad. Savannah's mom brought in sandwiches, and I spent the afternoon wincing every time I tried to get comfortable while the game went into extra innings. Her dad was easy to talk to, and the conversation drifted from army life to teaching to some of the kids he coached and his hopes for their future. I liked him. From my seat, I could hear Savannah and her mom chatting in the kitchen, and every now and then, Savannah would come into the living room with a basket of laundry to fold while her mother started another load in the washing machine. Though technically a college graduate and an adult, she still brought her dirty clothes home to mom. That night, we drove back to Chapel Hill, and Savannah showed me her new apartment. It was sparse in the furniture department, but it was relatively new, and it had both a gas fireplace and a small balcony that offered a view of the campus.
Despite the warm weather, she got the fire going, and we snacked on cheese and crackers, which, aside from cereal, was about all she had to offer. It felt indescribably romantic to me, though I'd come to realize that being alone with Savannah always struck me as romantic, and I reveled in it. We talked until nearly midnight, but Savannah was quieter than usual. In time, she wandered to the bedroom. When she didn't return, I went to find her. She was sitting on the bed, and I stopped in the doorway. She squeezed her hands together and drew a long breath.
"So,"
she began. "So," I responded, when she remained silent. She drew another long breath.
"It's getting late, and I've got an early class tomorrow."
I nodded. "You should probably get some sleep."
"Yeah,"
she said. She nodded, as if she hadn't considered it, and turned toward the window. Through the blinds, I could see shafts of light streaming in from the parking lot. She was cute when she was nervous.
"So,"
she said again, as if speaking to the wall. I held up my hands. "Why don't I sleep on the couch, okay?"
"You wouldn't mind?"
"Not at all," I said. Actually, it wasn't what I preferred, but I understood. Still staring toward the window, she made no move to get up.
"I'm just not ready,"
she said, her voice soft.
"I mean, I thought I was, and part of me really wants to. I've been thinking about it for the last few weeks, and I made up my mind, and it just seemed right, you know? I love you, and you love me, and this is what people do when they're in love. It was easy to tell myself that when you weren't here, but now..."
She trailed off. "It's okay," I said. At last, she turned toward me.
"Were you scared your first time?"
I wondered how best to answer that. "I think it's different for men and women," I said.
"Yeah, I suppose so."
She pretended to adjust the blankets.
"Are you mad?"
"Not at all."
"But you're disappointed."
"Well," I admitted, and she laughed.
"I'm sorry,"
she said. "There's no reason to apologize." She thought about it.